Tender is the Night, Disc 9.
Rosemary insisted on treating Dick to lunch next day. They went to a little trattoria kept by an Italian who had worked in America and ate ham and eggs and waffles. Afterward, they went to the hotel. Dick's discovery that he was not in love with her, nor she with him, had added to, rather than diminished, his passion for her. Now that he knew he would not enter further into her life, she became the strange woman for him. He supposed many men meant no more than that when they said they were in love, not a wild submergence of soul, a dipping of all colors into an obscuring dye, such as his love for Nicole had been. Certain thoughts about Nicole, that she should die, sink into mental darkness, love another man, made him physically sick. Nicotera was in Rosemary's sitting room, chattering about a professional matter. When Rosemary gave him his cue to go, he left with humorous protests and a rather insolent wink at Dick. As usual, the phone clamored, and Rosemary was engaged at it for 10 minutes, to Dick's increasing impatience. "Let's go up to my room," he suggested, and she agreed. She lay across his knees on a big sofa. He ran his fingers through the lovely forelocks of her hair. "Let me be curious about you again," he asked. "What do you want to know?" "About men. I'm curious, not to say prurient." "You mean how long after I met you? Or before?" "Oh, no," she was shocked. "There was nothing before. You were the first man I cared about. You're still the only man I really care about," she considered. "It was about a year, I think." "Who was it?" "Oh, a man." He closed in on her evasion. "I'll bet I can tell you about it. The first affair was unsatisfactory, and after that there was a long gap. The second was better, but you hadn't been in love with the man in the first place. The third was all right." Torturing himself, he ran on. "Then you had one real affair that fell of its own weight, and by that time you were getting afraid that you wouldn't have anything to give to the man you finally loved." He felt increasingly Victorian. "Afterwards, there were half a dozen just episodic affairs, right up to the present. Is that close?" She laughed between amusement and tears. "It's about as wrong as it could be," she said, to Dick's relief. "But someday I'm going to find somebody and love him, and never let him go." Now his phone rang, and Dick recognized Nicotera's voice asking for Rosemary. He put his palm over the transmitter. "Do you want to talk to him?" She went to the phone and jabbered in a rapid Italian Dick could not understand. "This telephoning takes time," he said. "It's after 4, and I have an engagement at 5. You better go play with Signor Nicotera."
"Don't be silly."
"Then I think that while I'm here, you ought to count him out."
"It's difficult."
She was suddenly crying.
"Dick, I do love you. Never anybody like you. But what have you got for me?"
"What has Nicotera got for anybody?"
"That's different.
Because youth called to youth."
"He's a spick," he said.
He was frantic with jealousy. He didn't want to be hurt again.
"He's only a baby," she said, sniffling. "You know I'm yours first."
In reaction, he put his arms about her, but she relaxed wearily backward. He held her like that for a moment, as in the end of an adagio, her eyes closed, her hair falling straight back like that of a girl drowned.
"Dick, let me go. I never felt so mixed up in my life."
He was a gruff, red bird, and instinctively she drew away from him as his unjustified jealousy began to snow over the qualities of consideration and understanding with which she felt at home. "I want to know the truth," he said. "Yes, then. We're a lot together. He wants to marry me, but I don't want to. What of it? What do you expect me to do? You never asked me to marry you. Do you want me to play around forever with half-wits like Collis Clay?" "You were with Nicotera last night?" "That's none of your business," she sobbed. "Excuse me, Dick, it is your business. You and Mother are the only two people in the world I care about."
"How about Nicotera?"
"How do I know?" She had achieved the elusiveness that gives hidden significance to the least significant remarks.
"Is it like you felt toward me in Paris?"
"I feel comfortable and happy when I'm with you. In Paris it was different. But you never know how you once felt, do you?"
He got up and began collecting his evening clothes. If he had to bring all the bitterness and hatred of the world into his heart, he was not going to be in love with her again.
"I don't care about Nicotera," she declared. "But I've got to go to Livorno with the company tomorrow. Oh, why did this have to happen?"
There was a new flood of tears.
"It's such a shame. Why did you come here? Why couldn't we just have the memory anyhow? I feel as if I'd quarreled with Mother."
As he began to dress, she got up and went to the door.
"I won't go to the party tonight."
It was her last effort.
"I'll stay with you. I don't want to go anyhow."
The tide began to flow again, but he retreated from it.
"I'll be in my room," she said. "Goodbye, Dick."
"Goodbye."
"Oh, such a shame, such a shame. Oh, such a shame. What's it all about, anyhow?"
"I've wondered for a long time."
"But why bring it to me?"
"I guess I'm the Black Death," he said slowly. "I don't seem to bring people happiness anymore."
XXII
There were five people in the Quirinal bar after dinner. A high-class Italian frail who sat on a stool making persistent conversation against the bartender's bored, "Si, si, si." A light, snobbish Egyptian who was lonely but chary of the woman and the two Americans. Dick was always vividly conscious of his surroundings, while Collis Clay lived vaguely, the sharpest impressions dissolving upon a recording apparatus that had early atrophied, so the former talked and the latter listened, like a man sitting in a breeze. Dick, worn away by the events of the afternoon, was taking it out on the inhabitants of Italy. He looked around the bar as if he hoped an Italian had heard him and would resent his words. "This afternoon I had tea with my sister-in-law at the Excelsior. We got the last table, and two men came up and looked around for a table and couldn't find one. So one of them came up to us and said, 'Isn't this table reserved for the Princess Orsini?' And I said, 'There was no sign on it.' And he said, 'But I think it's reserved for the Princess Orsini.' I couldn't even answer him."
"What did he do?"
"He retired." Dick switched around in his chair. "I don't like these people. The other day I left Rosemary for 2 minutes in front of a store, and an officer started walking up and down in front of her, tipping his hat."
"I don't know," said Collis after a moment. "I'd rather be here than up in Paris with somebody picking your pocket every minute."
He'd been enjoying himself, and he held out against anything that threatened to dull his pleasure.
"I don't know," he persisted. "I don't mind it here."
Dick evoked the picture that the few days had imprinted on his mind, and stared at it. The walk toward the American Express past the odorous confectionaries of the Via Nazionale,
through the foul tunnel up to the Spanish steps, where his spirit soared before the flower stalls, and the house where Keats had died. He cared only about people. He was scarcely conscious of places except for their weather, until they had been invested with color by tangible events. Rome was the end of his dream of Rosemary. A bellboy came in and gave him a note. "I did not go to the party," it said. "I am in my room. We leave for Livorno early in the morning." Dick handed the note and a tip to the boy. "Tell Miss Hoyt you couldn't find me." Turning to Collis, he suggested the bonbonieri. They inspected the tart at the bar, granting her the minimum of interest exacted by her profession, and she stared back with bright boldness. They went through the deserted lobby, oppressed by draperies holding Victorian dust in stuffy folds, and they nodded at the night concierge who returned the gesture with the bitter servility peculiar to night servants. Then, in a taxi, they rode along cheerless streets through a dank November night. There were no women in the streets, only pale men with dark coats buttoned to the neck, who stood in groups beside shoulders of cold stone. "My God!" Dick sighed. "What's the matter?" "I was thinking of that man this afternoon. This table is reserved for the Princess Orsini. Do you know what these old Roman families are? They're bandits. They're the ones who got possession of the temples and palaces after Rome went to pieces and preyed on the people." "I like Rome," insisted Collis. "Why won't you try the races?" "I don't like races. But all the women turn out—" "I know I wouldn't like anything here. I like France, where everybody thinks he's Napoleon. Down here, everybody thinks he's Christ." At the Bonbonieri, they descended to a paneled cabaret, hopelessly impermanent amid the cold stone. A listless band played a tango, and a dozen couples covered the wide floor with those elaborate and dainty steps so offensive to the American eye. A surplus of waiters precluded the stir and bustle that even a few busy men can create. Over the scene, as its form of animation, brooded an air of waiting for something, for the dance, the night, the balance of forces which kept it stable, to cease. It assured the impressionable guest that whatever he was seeking, he would not find it here. This was plain as plain to Dick. He looked around, hoping his eye would catch on something so that spirit instead of imagination could carry on for an hour, but there was nothing. And after a moment he turned back to Collis. He had told Collis some of his current notions, and he was bored with his audience's short memory and lack of response. After half an hour of Collis, he felt a distinct lesion of his own vitality. They drank a bottle of Italian Mousseau, and Dick became pale and somewhat noisy. He called the orchestra leader over to their table. This was a Bahama Negro, conceited and unpleasant, and in a few minutes there was a row. "You asked me to sit down." "All right, and I gave you 50 lire, didn't I?" "All right, all right, all right. All right, I gave you 50 lire, didn't I? Then you come up and ask me to put some more in the horn. You asked me to sit down, didn't you? Didn't you?" "I asked you to sit down, but I gave you 50 lire, didn't I? All right, all right." The Negro got up sourly and went away, leaving Dick in a still more evil humor. But he saw a girl smiling at him from across the room, and immediately the pale Roman shapes around him receded into decent, humble perspective. She was a young English girl, with blonde hair and a healthy, pretty English face, and she smiled at him again with an invitation he understood that denied the flesh even in the act of tendering it. "There's a quick trick, or else I don't know bridge," said Collis. Dick got up and walked to her across the room. "Won't you dance?" The middle-aged Englishman with whom she was sitting said almost apologetically, "I'm going out soon." Sobered by excitement, Dick danced. He found in the girl a suggestion of all the pleasant English things. The story of safe gardens ringed around by the sea was implicit in her bright voice. And as he leaned back to look at her, he meant what he said to her so sincerely that his voice trembled. When her current escort should leave, she promised to come and sit with them. The Englishman accepted her return with repeated apologies and smiles. Back at his table, Dick ordered another bottle of Spumante. "She looks like somebody in the movies," he said. "I can't think who." He glanced impatiently over his shoulder. "Wonder what's keeping her." "I'd like to get in the movies," said Collis thoughtfully. "I'm supposed to go into my father's business, but it doesn't appeal to me much, sitting in an office in Birmingham for 20 years. His voice resisted the pressure of materialistic civilization. "Too good for it?" suggested Dick. "No, I don't mean that." "Yes, you do. How do you know what I mean? Why don't you practice as a doctor if you like to work so much?" Dick had made them both wretched by this time. But simultaneously they had become vague with drink, and in a moment they forgot. Collis left, and they shook hands warmly. "Think it over," said Dick sagely. "Think what over?" "You know." It had been something about Collis going into his father's business. Good sound advice. Clay walked off into space. Dick finished his bottle, and then danced with the English girl again, conquering his unwilling body with bold revolutions and stern, determined marches down the floor. The most remarkable thing suddenly happened. He was dancing with the girl. The music stopped, and she had disappeared. "Have you seen her?"
"Seen who?"
"A girl I was dancing with. Suddenly disappeared. Must be in a building." "No, no, that's the ladies' room." He stood up by the bar. There were two other men there, but he could think of no way of starting a conversation. He could have told them all about Rome and the violent origins of the Colonna and Gaetani families, but he realized that as a beginning that would be somewhat abrupt. A row of Yancey dolls on the cigar counter fell suddenly to the floor. There was a subsequent confusion, and he had a sense of having been the cause of it, so he went back to the cabaret and drank a cup of black coffee. Collis was gone, and the English girl was gone, and there seemed nothing to do but go back to the hotel and lie down with his black heart. He paid his check and got his hat and coat. There was dirty water in the gutters and between the rough cobblestones. A marshy vapor from the Campania, a sweat of exhausted cultures, tainted the morning air. A quartet of taxi drivers, their little eyes bobbing in dark pouches, surrounded him. One who leaned insistently in his face, he pushed harshly away. "Quanto a Hotel Quirinal?"
"100 lire.
$6. He shook his head and offered 30 lire, which was twice the daytime fare, but they shrugged their shoulders as one pair and moved off.
35 lire a mancia,"
he said firmly.
100 lire,
he broke into English. "To go half a mile? You'll take me for 40 lire.
Oh, no."
He was very tired. He pulled open the door of a cab and got in.
"Hotel Quirinal,"
he said to the driver, who stood obstinately outside the window. "Wipe that sneer off your face and take me to the Quirinal."
"Ah, no."
Dick got out. By the door of the Bonbonnieri, someone was arguing with the taxi drivers, someone who now tried to explain their attitude to Dick. Again, one of the men pressed close, insisting and gesticulating, and Dick shoved him away.
"I want to go to the Quirinal Hotel."
"He says 100 lire,
explained the interpreter.
I understand. I'll give him 50 lire. Go on away.
This last to the insistent man who had edged up once more. The man looked at him and spat contemptuously. The passionate impatience of the weak leaped up in Dick and clothed itself like a flash in violence, the honorable, the traditional resource of his land. He stepped forward and slapped the man's face. They surged about him, threatening, waving their arms, trying ineffectually to close in on him. With his back against the wall, Dick hit out, clumsily, laughing a little, and for a few minutes the mock fight, an affair of foiled rushes and padded, glancing blows, swayed back and forth in front of the door. Then Dick tripped and fell. He was hurt somewhere, but he struggled up again, wrestling in arms that suddenly broke apart. There was a new voice and a new argument, but he leaned against the wall, panting and furious at the indignity of his position. He saw there was no sympathy for him, but he was unable to believe that he was wrong. They were going to the police station and settle it there. His hat was retrieved and handed to him, and with someone holding his arm lightly, he strode around the corner with the taxi men and entered a bare barrack where Carabinieri lounged under a single dim light. At a desk sat a captain, to whom the officious individual who had stopped the battle spoke at length in Italian, at times pointing at Dick and letting himself be interrupted by the taxi men, who delivered short bursts of invective and denunciation. The captain began to nod impatiently. He held up his hand, and the hydra-headed address, with a few parting exclamations, died away. Then he turned to Dick.
"Speak Italiano?"
he asked.
"No." "Speak Francais?"
"Oui,"
said Dick, glowering.
"Alors, écoute. Va au Quirinal. Espèce d'endormi. Écoute, vous êtes sous. Payez ce que le chauffeur demande, comprenez-vous?"
Diver shook his head.
"Non, je ne veux pas."
"Combien?"
"Je paierai 40 lire. C'est bien assez."
The captain stood up.
"Écoute," he cried portentously. "Vous êtes sous. Vous avez battu le chauffeur. Comme ci, comme ça."
He struck the air excitedly with right hand and left.
"C'est bon que je vous donne la liberté. Payez ce qu'il a dit. 100 lire. Va au Quirinal."
Raging with humiliation, Dick stared back at him.
"All right."
He turned blindly to the door. Before him, leering and nodding, was the man who had brought him to the police station.
"I'll go home," he shouted, "but first I'll fix this baby."
He walked past the staring Carabinieri and up to the grinning face, hit it with a smashing left beside the jaw. The man dropped to the floor. For a moment he stood over him in savage triumph, but even as a first pang of doubt shot through him, the world reeled. He was clubbed down, and fists and boots beat on him in a savage tattoo. He felt his nose break like a shingle, and his eyes jerk as if they had snapped back on a rubber band into his head. A rib splintered under a stamping heel. Momentarily he lost consciousness, regained it as he was raised to a sitting position and his wrists jerked together with handcuffs. He struggled automatically. The plainclothes lieutenant, whom he had knocked down, stood dabbing his jaw with a handkerchief and looking into it for blood. He came over to Dick, poised himself, drew back his arm, and smashed him to the floor. When Dr. Diver lay quite still, a pail of water was sloshed over him. One of his eyes opened dimly as he was being dragged along by the wrists through a bloody haze, and he made out the human and ghastly face of one of the taxi drivers.
"Go to the Excelsior Hotel," he cried faintly. "Tell Miss Warren. 200 lire. Miss Warren, 200 lire. Oh, you dirty, you god—"
Still he was dragged along through the bloody haze, choking and sobbing,
over vague, irregular surfaces into some small place where he was dropped upon a stone floor. The men went out. A door clanged. He was alone. Until 1 o'clock, Baby Warren lay in bed, reading one of Marion Crawford's curiously inanimate Roman stories. Then she went to a window and looked down into the street. Across from the hotel, two carabinieri, grotesque in swaddling capes and harlequin hats, swung voluminously from this side and that, like mainsails coming about, and watching them she thought of the guard's officer, who had stared at her so intensely at lunch. He had possessed the arrogance of a tall member of a short race, with no obligation save to be tall. Had he come up to her and said, "Let's go along, you and I," she would have answered, "Why not?" At least it seemed so now, for she was still disembodied by an unfamiliar background. Her thoughts drifted back slowly through the guardsmen to the two carabinieri, to Dick. She got into bed and turned out the light. A little before 4, she was awakened by a brusque knocking.
"Yes, what is it?"
"It's the concierge, madame." She pulled on her kimono and faced him sleepily. "Your friend named Diver, he's in trouble. He had trouble with the police, and they have him in the jail. He sent a taxi up to tell. The driver says that he promised him 200 lire. He paused cautiously for this to be approved. "The driver says Mr. Diver in the bad trouble. He had a fight with the police and is terribly bad hurt."
"I'll be right down."
She dressed to an accompaniment of anxious heartbeats, and 10 minutes later stepped out of the elevator into the dark lobby. The chauffeur who brought the message was gone. The concierge hailed another one and told him the location of the jail. As they rode, the darkness lifted and thinned outside, and Baby's nerves, scarcely awake, cringed faintly at the unstable balance between night and day. She began to race against the day. Sometimes on the broad avenues she gained, but whenever the thing that was pushing up paused for a moment, gusts of wind blew here and there impatiently, and the slow creep of light began once more. The cab went past a loud fountain, splashing in a voluminous shadow, turned into an alley so curved that the buildings were warped and strained following it, bumped and rattled over cobblestones, and stopped with a jerk where 2 sentry boxes were bright against a wall of green damp. Suddenly, from the violet darkness of an archway, came Dick's voice, shouting and screaming, "Are there any English? Are there any Americans? Are there any English? Are there any... Oh, my God, you dirty wops!" His voice died away, and she heard a dull sound of beating on the door. Then the voice began again. "Are there any Americans? Are there any English?" Following the voice, she ran through the arch into a court, whirled about in momentary confusion, and located the small guardroom whence the cries came. 2 carabinieri started to their feet, but Baby brushed past them to the door of the cell. "Dick," she called, "what's the trouble?" "They've put out my eye," he cried. "They handcuffed me, and then they beat me. The goddamn... the..." Flashing around, Baby took a step toward the 2 carabinieri. "What have you done to him?" she whispered so fiercely that they flinched before her gathering fury.
"Non capisco inglese."
In French, she execrated them. Her wild, confident rage filled the room, enveloped them until they shrank and wriggled from the garments of blame with which she invested them. "Do something! Do something! We can do nothing until we are ordered! Bene, bene, bene!" Once more, Baby let her passion scorch around them until they sweated out apologies for their impotence, looking at each other with the sense that something had, after all, gone terribly wrong. Baby went to the cell door, leaned against it, almost caressing it, as if that could make Dick feel her presence and power, and cried, "I'm going to the embassy. I'll be back."
throwing a last glance of infinite menace at the carabinieri, she ran out. She drove to the American embassy, where she paid off the taxi driver upon his insistence. It was still dark when she ran up the steps and pressed the bell. She had pressed it 3 times before a sleepy English porter opened the door to her. "I want to see someone," she said. "Anyone, but right away." "No one's awake, madame. We don't open until 9 o'clock. Impatiently she waved the hour away. "This is important. A man, an American, has been terribly beaten. He's in an Italian jail." "No one's awake now. At 9 o'clock, I can't wait. They've put out a man's eye, my brother-in-law, and they won't let him out of jail. I must talk to someone. Can't you see? Are you crazy? Are you an idiot? You stand there with that look in your face?" "I'm unable to do anything, madame." "You've got to wake someone up." She seized him by the shoulders and jerked him violently. "It's a matter of life and death. If you won't wake someone, a terrible thing will happen to you. Kindly don't lay hands on me, madam." From above and behind the porter floated down a weary, groton voice. "What is it there?" The porter answered with relief. "It's a lady, sir, and she has shook me." He had stepped back to speak, and Baby pushed forward into the hall. On an upper landing, just aroused from sleep, and wrapped in a white embroidered Persian robe, stood a singular young man. His face was of a monstrous and unnatural pink, vivid yet dead, and over his mouth was fastened what appeared to be a gag. When he saw Baby, he moved his head back into a shadow. "What is it?" he repeated. Baby told him, in her agitation edging forward to the stairs. In the course of her story, she realized that the gag was in reality a mustache bandage, and that the man's face was covered with pink cold cream, but the fact fitted quietly into the nightmare. The thing to do, she cried passionately, was for him to come to the jail with her at once and get Dick out. "It's a bad business," he said. "Yes," she agreed conciliatingly, "yes, this trying to fight the police." A note of personal affront crept into his voice. "I'm afraid there's nothing to be done until 9 o'clock. "Till 9 o'clock," she repeated aghast. "But you can do something, certainly. You can come to the jail with me and see that they don't hurt him any more." "We aren't permitted to do anything like that. The consulate handles these things. The consulate will be open at 9. His face, constrained to impassivity by the binding strap, infuriated Baby. "I can't wait until 9. My brother-in-law says they've put his eye out. He's seriously hurt. I have to get to him. I have to find a doctor." She let herself go and began to cry angrily as she talked, for she knew that he would respond to her agitation rather than her words. "You've got to do something about this. It's your business to protect American citizens in trouble." But he was of the eastern seaboard, and too hard for her. Shaking his head patiently at her failure to understand his position, he drew the Persian robe closer about him and came down a few steps. "Write down the address of the consulate for this lady," he said to the porter, "and look up Dr. Colazzo's address and telephone number and write that down, too." He turned to Baby with the expression of an exasperated Christ. "My dear lady, the diplomatic corps represents the government of the United States to the government of Italy. It has nothing to do with the protection of citizens except under specific instructions from the State Department. Your brother-in-law has broken the laws of this country and been put in jail, just as an Italian might be put in jail in New York. The only people who can let him go are the Italian courts, and if your brother-in-law has a case, you can get aid and advice from the consulate, which protects the rights of American citizens. The consulate does not open until 9 o'clock. Even if it were my brother, I couldn't do anything." "Can you phone the consulate?" she broke in. "We can't interfere with the consulate. When the consul gets there at 9, can you give me his home address? After a fractional pause, the man shook his head. He took the memorandum from the porter and gave it to her. Now I'll ask you to excuse me. He had maneuvered her to the door. For an instant the violet dawn fell shrilly upon his pink mask and upon the linen sack that supported his mustache. Then Baby was standing on the front steps alone. She had been in the embassy 10 minutes. The piazza whereon it faced was empty save for an old man gathering cigarette butts with a spiked stick. Baby caught a taxi presently and went to the consulate, but there was no one there save a trio of wretched women scrubbing the stairs. She could not make them understand that she wanted the consul's home address. In a sudden resurgence of anxiety, she rushed out and told the chauffeur to take her to the jail. He did not know where it was, but by the use of the words semper, dritte, dextra, sinistra, she maneuvered him to its approximate locality, where she dismounted and explored a labyrinth of familiar alleys, but the buildings and the alleys all looked alike. Emerging from one trail into the Piazza d'Espagna, she saw the American Express Company, and her heart lifted at the word American on the sign. There was a light in the window, and hurrying across the square, she tried the door, but it was locked, and inside the clock stood at 7. Then she thought of Collis Clay. She remembered the name of his hotel, a stuffy villa sealed in red plush across from the Excelsior. The woman on duty at the office was not disposed to help her. She had no authority to disturb Mr. Clay, and refused to let Miss Warren go up to his room alone. Convinced finally that this was not an affair of passion, she accompanied her. Collis lay naked upon his bed. He had come in tight, and awakening, it took him some moments to realize his nudity. He atoned for it by an excess of modesty. Taking his clothes into the bathroom, he dressed in haste, muttering to himself, "Gosh, he certainly must have got a good look at me." After some telephoning, he and Baby found the jail and went to it. The cell door was open, and Dick was slumped on a chair in the guard room. The carabinieri had washed some of the blood from his face, brushed him, and set his hat concealingly upon his head. Baby stood in the doorway, trembling. "Mr. Clay will stay with you," she said. "I want to get the consul and a doctor." "All right. Just stay quiet." "All right. I'll be back." She drove to the consulate. It was after 8 now, and she was permitted to sit in the anteroom. Toward 9, the consul came in, and Baby, hysterical with impotence and exhaustion, repeated her story. The consul was disturbed. He warned her against getting into brawls in strange cities, but he was chiefly concerned that she should wait outside. With despair, she read in his elderly eye that he wanted to be mixed up as little as possible in this catastrophe. Waiting on his action, she passed the minutes by phoning a doctor to go to Dick. There were other people in the anteroom, and several were admitted to the consul's office. After half an hour, she chose the moment of someone's coming out and pushed past the secretary into the room. "This is outrageous. An American has been beaten half to death and thrown into prison, and you make no move to help." "Just a minute, Mrs. I've waited long enough. You come right down to the jail and get him out." "Mrs., we're people of considerable standing in America." Her mouth hardened as she continued. "If it wasn't for the scandal, we can... I shall see that your indifference to this matter is reported in the proper quarter. If my brother-in-law were a British citizen, he'd have been free hours ago, but you're more concerned with what the police will think than about what you're here for. Mrs., you put on your hat and come with me right away." The mention of his hat alarmed the consul, who began to clean his spectacles hurriedly and to ruffle his papers. This proved of no avail. The American woman, aroused, stood over him. The clean-sweeping, irrational temper that had broken the moral back of a race and made a nursery out of a continent was too much for him. He rang for the vice-consul. Baby had won. Dick sat in the sunshine that fell profusely through the guard-room window. Collis was with him and two carabinieri, and they were waiting for something to happen. With the narrowed vision of his one eye, Dick could see the carabinieri. They were Tuscan peasants with short upper lips, and he found it difficult to associate them with the brutality of last night. He sent one of them to fetch him a glass of beer. The beer made him light-headed, and the episode was momentarily illumined by a ray of sardonic humor. Collis was under the impression that the English girl had something to do with the catastrophe, but Dick was sure she had disappeared long before it happened. Collis was still absorbed by the fact that Miss Warren had found him naked on his bed. Dick's rage had retreated into him a little, and he felt a vast criminal irresponsibility. What had happened to him was so awful that nothing could make any difference unless he could choke it to death, and as this was unlikely, he was hopeless. He would be a different person henceforward. And in his raw state, he had bizarre feelings of what the new self would be. The matter had about it the impersonal quality of an act of God. No mature Aryan is able to profit by a humiliation. When he forgives, it has become part of his life. He has identified himself with the thing which has humiliated him. An upshot that, in this case, was impossible. When Collis spoke of retribution, Dick shook his head and was silent. A lieutenant of Carabinieri, pressed, burnished, vital, came into the room like three men, and the guards jumped to attention. He seized the empty beer bottle and directed a stream of scolding at his men. The new spirit was in him, and the first thing was to get the beer bottle out of the guard room. Dick looked at Collis and laughed. The vice consul, an overworked young man named Swanson, arrived, and they started to the court. Collis and Swanson on either side of Dick, and the two carabinieri close behind. It was a yellow, hazy morning. The squares and arcades were crowded, and Dick, pulling his hat low over his head, walked fast, setting the pace, until one of the short-legged carabinieri ran alongside and protested. Swanson arranged matters. "I've disgraced you, haven't I?" said Dick jovially. "You're liable to get killed fighting Italians," replied Swanson sheepishly. "They'll probably let you go this time, but if you were an Italian, you'd get a couple of months in prison. And how?" "Have you ever been in prison?" Swanson laughed. "I like him," announced Dick to Clay. "He's a very likable young man, and he gives people excellent advice, but I'll bet he's been to jail himself. Probably spent weeks at a time in jail." Swanson laughed. "I mean, you want to be careful. You don't know how these people are." "Oh, I know how they are," broke out Dick irritably. "They're goddamn stinkers." He turned around to the carabinieri. "Did you get that?" "I'm leaving you here," Swanson said quickly. "I told your sister-in-law I would. Our lawyer will meet you upstairs in the courtroom. You want to be careful." "Goodbye," Dick shook hands politely. "Thank you very much. I feel you have a future." With another smile, Swanson hurried away, resuming his official expression of disapproval. Now they came into a courtyard, on all four sides of which outer stairways mounted to the chambers above. As they crossed the flags, a groaning, hissing, booing sound went up from the loiterers in the courtyard, voices full of fury and scorn. Dick stared about. "What's that?" he demanded, aghast. One of the carabinieri spoke to a group of men, and the sound died away. They came into the courtroom. A shabby Italian lawyer from the consulate spoke at length to the judge while Dick and Collis waited aside. Someone who knew English turned from the window that gave on the yard and explained the sound that had accompanied their passage through. A native of Frascati had raped and slain a 5-year-old child and was to be brought in that morning. The crowd had assumed it was Dick. In a few minutes, the lawyer told Dick that he was freed. The court considered him punished enough. "Enough!" Dick cried. "Punished for what?" "Come along," said Collis. "You can't do anything now. But what did I do except get into a fight with some taxi men? They claim you went up to a detective as if you were going to shake hands with him and hit him. That's not true. I told him I was going to hit him. I didn't know he was a detective.
You better go along, urged the lawyer.
Come along, Collis took his arm, and they descended the steps. I want to make a speech, Dick cried. I want to explain to these people how I raped a 5-year-old girl. Maybe I did. Come along. Baby was waiting with a doctor in a taxicab. Dick did not want to look at her, and he disliked the doctor, whose stern manner revealed him as one of that least palpable of European types, the Latin moralist. Dick summed up his conception of the disaster, but no one had much to say. In his room in the Quirinal, the doctor washed off the rest of the blood and the oily sweat, set his nose, his fractured ribs and fingers, disinfected the smaller wounds, and put a hopeful dressing on the eye. Dick asked for a quarter of a grain of morphine, for he was still wide awake and full of nervous energy. With the morphine, he fell asleep. The doctor and Collis left, and Baby waited with him until a woman could arrive from the English nursing home. It had been a hard night, but she had the satisfaction of feeling that whatever Dick's previous record was, they now possessed a moral superiority over him for as long as he proved of any use. Book 3 1 Frau Käthe Gregorovius overtook her husband on the path of their villa. How was Nicole? She asked mildly. But she spoke out of breath, giving away the fact that she had held the question in her mind during her run. Franz looked at her in surprise. "Nicole's not sick. What makes you ask, dearest one?" "You see her so much, I thought she must be sick." "We will talk of this in the house." Käthe agreed meekly. His study was over in the administration building, and the children were with their tutor in the living room. They went up to the bedroom.
"Excuse me, Franz," said Käthe before he could speak. "Excuse me, dear, I had no right to say that. I know my obligations, and I am proud of them. But there is a bad feeling between Nicole and me."
"Birds in their little nests agree,"
Franz thundered. Finding the tone inappropriate to the sentiment, he repeated his command in the spaced and considered rhythm with which his old master, Dr. Daimler, could cast significance on the tritest platitude.
"Birds in their nests agree."
"I realize that. You haven't seen me fail in courtesy toward Nicole."
"I see you failing in common sense. Nicole is half a patient. She will possibly remain something of a patient all her life. In the absence of Dick, I am responsible."
He hesitated. Sometimes, as a quiet joke, he tried to keep news from Käthe. "There was a cable from Rome this morning. Dick has had grip and is starting home tomorrow." Relieved, Käthe pursued her course in a less personal tone.
"I think Nicole is less sick than anyone thinks. She only cherishes her illness as an instrument of power. She ought to be in the cinema like your Norma Talmadge. That's where all American women would be happy."
"Are you jealous of Norma Talmadge on a film?"
"I don't like Americans. They're selfish, selfish."
"You like Dick?"
"I like him," she admitted. "He's different. He thinks of others."
"And so does Norma Talmadge," Franz said to himself.
"Norma Talmadge must be a fine, noble woman beyond her loveliness. They must compel her to play foolish roles. Norma Talmadge must be a woman whom it would be a great privilege to know."
Käthe had forgotten about Norma Talmadge.
a vivid shadow that she had fretted bitterly upon one night as they were driving home from the movies in Zurich. "Dick married Nicole for her money," she said. "That was his weakness. You hinted as much yourself one night. You're being malicious." "I shouldn't have said that," she retracted. "We must all live together like birds, as you say. But it's difficult when Nicole acts as... when Nicole pulls herself back a little, as if she were holding her breath, as if I smelt bad." Cater had touched a material truth. She did most of her work herself. And, frugal, she bought few clothes. An American shop girl, laundering 2 changes of underwear every night, would have noticed a hint of yesterday's reawakened sweat about Cater's person. Less a smell than an ammoniacal reminder of the eternity of toil and decay. To Franz, this was as natural as the thick, dark scent of Cater's hair, and he would have missed it equally. But to Nicole, born hating the smell of a nurse's fingers dressing her, it was an offense only to be endured. "And the children," Cater continued. "She doesn't like them to play with our children." But Franz had heard enough. "Hold your tongue. That kind of talk can hurt me professionally, since we owe this clinic to Nicole's money. Let us have lunch." Cater realized that her outburst had been ill-advised. But Franz's last remark reminded her that other Americans had money, and a week later she put her dislike of Nicole into new words. The occasion was the dinner they tendered the divers upon Dick's return. Hardly had their footfalls ceased on the path when she shut the door and said to Franz, "Did you see around his eyes? He's been on a debauch." "Go gently," Franz requested. "Dick told me about that as soon as he came home. He was boxing on the transatlantic ship. The American passengers box a lot on these transatlantic ships." "I believe that," she scoffed. "It hurts him to move one of his arms, and he has an unhealed scar on his temple. You can see where the hair's been cut away." Franz had not noticed these details. "But what?" Cater demanded. "Do you think that sort of thing does the clinic any good? The liquor I smelt on him tonight, and several other times since he's been back." She slowed her voice to fit the gravity of what she was about to say. "Dick is no longer a serious man." Franz rocked his shoulders up the stairs, shaking off her persistence. In their bedroom, he turned on her. "He is most certainly a serious man, and a brilliant man. Of all the men who have recently taken their degrees in neuropathology in Zurich, Dick has been regarded as the most brilliant, more brilliant than I could ever be." "For shame. It's the truth. The shame would be not to admit it. I turn to Dick when cases are highly involved. His publications are still standard in their line. Go into any medical library and ask. Most students think he's an Englishman. They don't believe that such thoroughness could come out of America." He groaned domestically, taking his pajamas from under the pillow. "I can't understand why you talk this way, Cater. I thought you liked him." "For shame," Cater said. "You're the solid one. You do the work. It's a case of hare and tortoise, and in my opinion, the hare's race is almost done." "Very well, then it's true." With his open hand, he pushed down air briskly. "Stop!" The upshot was that they had exchanged viewpoints like debaters. Cater admitted to herself that she had been too hard on Dick, whom she admired and of whom she stood in awe, who had been so appreciative and understanding of herself. As for Franz, once Cater's idea had had time to sink in, he never after believed that Dick was a serious person. And as time went on, he convinced himself that he had never thought so. 2. Dick told Nicole an expurgated version of the catastrophe in Rome. In his version, he had gone philanthropically to the rescue of a drunken friend. He could trust Baby Warren to hold her tongue, since he had painted the disastrous effect of the truth upon Nicole. All this, however, was a low hurdle compared to the lingering effect of the episode upon him. In reaction, he took himself for an intensified beating in his work, so that Franz, trying to break with him, could find no basis on which to begin a disagreement. No friendship worth the name was ever destroyed in an hour without some painful flesh being torn. So Franz let himself believe with ever-increasing conviction that Dick traveled intellectually and emotionally at such a rate of speed that the vibrations jarred him. This was a contrast that had previously been considered a virtue in their relation. So, for the shoddiness of needs, are shoes made out of last year's hide. Yet it was May before Franz found an opportunity to insert the first wedge. Dick came into his office, white and tired, one noon, and sat down, saying, "Well, she's gone. She's dead. The heart quit." Dick sat exhausted in the chair nearest the door. During 3 nights he had remained with the scabbed, anonymous woman artist he had come to love, formally to portion out the adrenaline, but really to throw as much wan light as he could into the darkness ahead. Half appreciating his feeling, Franz traveled quickly over an opinion. "It was neurosyphilis. All the Wassermans we took won't tell me differently. The spinal fluid—"
"Never mind," said Dick.
"Oh, God, never mind. If she cared enough about her secret to take it away with her, let it go at that. You better lay off for a day." "Don't worry, I'm going to." Franz had his wedge. Looking up from the telegram that he was writing to the woman's brother, he inquired, "Or do you want to take a little trip?" "Not now. I don't mean a vacation. There's a case in Lausanne. I've been on the phone with a Chilean all morning."
"She was so damn brave," said Dick.
"And it took her so long." Franz shook his head sympathetically, and Dick got himself together. "Excuse me for interrupting you. This is just a change. The situation is a father's problem with his son. The father can't get the son up here. He wants somebody to come down there."
"What is it? Alcoholism? Homosexuality? When you say Lausanne,
a little of everything."
"I'll go down. Is there any money in it?"
"Quite a lot, I'd say. Count on staying 2 or 3 days, and get the boy up here if he needs to be watched. In any case, take your time, take your ease. Combine business with pleasure." After 2 hours' train sleep, Dick felt renewed, and he approached the interview with Señor Pardo Iquidad Real in good spirits. These interviews were much of a type. Often the sheer hysteria of the family representative was as interesting psychologically as the condition of the patient. This one was no exception. Señor Pardo Iquidad Real, a handsome iron-gray Spaniard, noble of carriage, with all the appurtenances of wealth and power, raged up and down his suite in the Hôtel des Trois Mondes, and told the story of his son with no more self-control than a drunken woman. "I am at the end of my invention. My son is corrupt. He was corrupt at Harrow. He was corrupt at King's College, Cambridge. He's incorrigibly corrupt. Now that there is this drinking, it is more and more obvious how he is, and there is continual scandal. I have tried everything. I worked out a plan with a doctor friend of mine, sent them together for a tour of Spain. Every evening Francisco had an injection of cantharides, and then the two went together to a reputable bordello. For a week or so it seemed to work, but the result was nothing. Finally, last week, in this very room, rather in that bathroom," he pointed at it, "I made Francisco strip to the waist and lashed him with a whip." Exhausted with his emotion, he sat down, and Dick spoke. "That was foolish. The trip to Spain was futile also."
He struggled against an upsurging hilarity. That any reputable medical man should have lent himself to such an amateurish experiment. Senor, I must tell you that in these cases we can promise nothing. In the case of the drinking, we can often accomplish something with proper cooperation. The first thing is to see the boy and get enough of his confidence to find whether he has any insight into the matter. The boy with whom he sat on the terrace was about 20, handsome and alert. "I'd like to know your attitude," Dick said. "Do you feel that the situation is getting worse? And do you want to do anything about it?"
"I suppose I do," said Francisco. "I am very unhappy."
"Do you think it's from the drinking or from the abnormality?"
"I think the drinking is caused by the other."
He was serious for a while. Suddenly, an irrepressible facetiousness broke through, and he laughed, saying, "It's hopeless. At King's, I was known as the Queen of Chile. That trip to Spain, all it did was to make me nauseated by the sight of a woman." Dick caught him up sharply. "If you're happy in this mess, then I can't help you, and I'm wasting my time.
No, let's talk. I despise most of the others, so."
There was some manliness in the boy, perverted now into an active resistance to his father, but he had that typically roguish look in his eyes that homosexuals assume in discussing the subject. "It's a hole-and-corner business at best," Dick told him. "You'll spend your life on it, and its consequences, and you won't have time or energy for any other decent or social act. If you want to face the world, you'll have to begin by controlling your sensuality. And first of all, the drinking that provokes it." He talked automatically, having abandoned the case 10 minutes before. They talked pleasantly through another hour about the boy's home in Chile and about his ambitions. It was as close as Dick had ever come to comprehending such a character from any but the pathological angle. He gathered that this very charm made it possible for Francisco to perpetrate his outrages. And for Dick, charm always had an independent existence. Whether it was the mad gallantry of the wretch who had died in the clinic this morning, or the courageous grace which this lost young man brought to a drab old story. Dick tried to dissect it into pieces small enough to store away, realizing that the totality of a life may be different in quality from its segments, and also that life during the 40s seemed capable of being observed only in segments. His love for Nicole and Rosemary, his friendship with Abe North, with Tommy Barbin in the broken universe of the war's ending, in such contacts the personalities had seemed to press up so close to him that he became the personality itself. There seemed some necessity of taking all or nothing. It was as if, for the remainder of his life, he was condemned to carry with him the egos of certain people early met and early loved, and to be only as complete as they were complete themselves. There was some element of loneliness involved, so easy to be loved, so hard to love. As he sat on the veranda with young Francisco, a ghost of the past swam into his ken. A tall, singularly swaying male detached himself from the shrubbery and approached Dick and Francisco with feeble resolution. For a moment he formed such an apologetic part of the vibrant landscape that Dick scarcely remarked him. Then Dick was on his feet, shaking hands with an abstracted air, thinking, "My God, I've stirred up a nest," and trying to collect the man's name. "This is Dr. Diver, isn't it? Well, well, Mr. Dumfrey, isn't it? Royal Dumfrey, I had the pleasure of having dinner one night in that lovely garden of yours." "Of course." Trying to dampen Mr. Dumfrey's enthusiasm, Dick went into impersonal chronology. "It was in 1924, or 25. He had remained standing, but Royal Dumfrey, shy as he had seemed at first, was no laggard with his pick and spade. He spoke to Francisco in a flip, intimate manner, but the latter, ashamed of him, joined Dick in trying to freeze him away. "Dr. Diver, one thing I want to say before you go. I've never forgotten that evening in your garden. How nice you and your wife were. To me it's one of the finest memories in my life, one of the happiest ones. I've always thought of it as the most civilized gathering of people that I have ever known." Dick continued a crab-like retreat toward the nearest door of the hotel. "I'm glad you remembered it so pleasantly. Now I've got to see—" "I understand," Royal Dumfrey pursued sympathetically. "I hear he's dying."
"Who's dying?"
"Perhaps I shouldn't have said that. But we have the same physician." Dick paused, regarding him in astonishment.
"Who are you talking about?"
"Why, your wife's father. Perhaps I—"
"My what?"
"I suppose you mean I'm the first person—"
"You mean my wife's father is here in Lausanne?"
"Why, I thought you knew. I thought that was why you were here.
What doctor's taking care of him?"
Dick scrawled the name in a notebook, excused himself, and hurried to a telephone booth. It was convenient for Dr. Danger to see Dr. Diver at his house immediately. Dr. Danger was a young Genevois. For a moment he was afraid that he was going to lose a profitable patient, but when Dick reassured him, he divulged the fact that Mr. Warren was, indeed, dying.
"He is only 50, but the liver has stopped restoring itself. The precipitating factor is alcoholism."
"Doesn't respond?"
"The man can take nothing except liquids. I give him 3 days, or at most a week."
"Does his elder daughter, Miss Warren, know his condition?"
"By his own wish, no one knows except the manservant. It was only this morning I felt I had to tell him. He took it excitedly, although he has been in a very religious and resigned mood from the beginning of his illness."
Dick considered. "Well," he decided slowly, "in any case, I'll take care of the family angle. But I imagine they would want a consultation."
"As you like.
I know I speak for them when I ask you to call in one of the best-known medicine men around the lake, Herr Brugge, from Geneva."
"I was thinking of Herr Brugge.
Meanwhile, I'm here for a day at least, and I'll keep in touch with you." That evening, Dick went to Señor Pardo Equidad Real, and they talked.
"We have large estates in Chile," said the old man. "My son could well be taking care of them, or I can get him in any one of a dozen enterprises in Paris."
He shook his head and paced across the windows against a spring rain so cheerful that it didn't even drive the swans to cover.
"My only son! Can't you take him with you?"
The Spaniard knelt suddenly at Dick's feet.
"Can't you cure my only son? I believe in you. You can take him with you. Cure him."
"It's impossible to commit a person on such grounds. I wouldn't if I could." The Spaniard got up from his knees.
"I have been hasty. I have been driven."
Descending to the lobby, Dick met Dr. Danger in the elevator.
"I was about to call your room," the latter said. "Can we speak out on the terrace?"
"Is Mr. Warren dead?" Dick demanded.
"He is the same. The consultation is in the morning. Meanwhile, he wants to see his daughter, your wife, with the greatest fervor. It seems there was some quarrel."
"I know all about that." The doctors looked at each other, thinking.
"Why don't you talk to him before you make up your mind?" Danger suggested. "His death will be graceful, merely a weakening and sinking."
With an effort, Dick consented.
"All right."
The suite in which Devereux Warren was gracefully weakening and sinking was of the same size as that of the Señor Pardo Equidad Real. Throughout this hotel, there were many chambers wherein rich ruins fugitives from justice, claimants to the thrones of mediatized principalities, lived on the derivatives of opium or barbitol, listening eternally as to an inescapable radio to the coarse melodies of old sins. This corner of Europe does not so much draw people as accept them without inconvenient questions. Routes cross here, people bound for private sanitariums or tuberculosis resorts in the mountains, people who are no longer persona gratis in France or Italy. The suite was darkened. A nun with a holy face was nursing the man whose emaciated fingers stirred a rosary on the white sheet. He was still handsome, and his voice summoned up a thick burr of individuality as he spoke to Dick, after Danger had left them together.
"We get a lot of understanding at the end of life. Only now, Dr. Diver, do I realize what it was all about."
Dick waited.
"I've been a bad man. You must know how little right I have to see Nicole again. Yet a bigger man than either of us says to forgive and to pity."
The rosary slipped from his weak hands and slid off the smooth bed covers. Dick picked it up for him.
"If I could see Nicole for 10 minutes, I would go happy out of the world."
"It's not a decision I can make for myself," said Dick. "Nicole is not strong." He made his decision, but pretended to hesitate. "I can put it up to my professional associate."
"What your associate says goes with me." "Very well, Doctor. Let me tell you, my debt to you is so large."
Dick stood up quickly. "I'll let you know the result through Dr. Danger." In his room, he called the clinic on the Zugersee. After a long time, Keita answered from her own house.
"I want to get in touch with Franz. Franz is up on the mountain. I'm going up myself. Is it something I can tell him, Dick?"
"It's about Nicole. Her father is dying here in Lausanne. Tell Franz that, to show him it's important, and ask him to phone me from up there."
"I will."
"Tell him I'll be in my room here at the hotel from 3 to 5, and again from 7 to 8, and after that to page me in the dining room." In plotting these hours, he forgot to add that Nicole was not to be told. When he remembered it, he was talking into a dead telephone. Certainly, Keita should realize.
This ends Disc 9.